Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Activist Lawyer. Today, I am joined by Executive Director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, Liam Hurech. Thank you, Liam, for joining me today.
Morning, Sarah.
Great to have you. So just by way of quick introduction to Liam and his background for our listeners. So Liam was appointed Executive Director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, ICCL, in November 2016. And prior to his appointment, he worked as advisor to President Michael D. Higgins. Liam was Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust between 2007 and 2014, and he also worked as the Head of Legislation and Policy at the former Irish Human Rights Commission with the Law Reform Commission and at the Department of Foreign Affairs. Liam is a former member of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission, IREC, and the Minister for Justice and Equality Strategic Review Group on Penal Policy. So thank you again for joining me today. So Liam, perhaps we could firstly take a look, a glance at your extensive and very interesting career history leading you to where you are today.
Great. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's just the first thing is to put in a kind of a qualifier. I'm only a kind of lawyer in the sense that I studied law for my undergraduate degree back in the mid-90s, and I have a master's in law from UCC in Cork, but I never qualified as a solicitor or barrister. My work really over the last 25 years has been mainly in the areas of working around legislation and development of policy, but I suppose from my time in college I had a particular interest in human rights law, criminal law and constitutional law. So the kind of roles I had when I came out of college, I had an internship in the Human Rights Unit at the Department of Foreign Affairs, which really exposed me to kind of the UN and European systems of human rights. And I worked in the Law Reform Commission as a legal researcher on a report on statutory drafting and interpretation. And it's kind of a nerdy area of law, but one that kind of I always feel is fundamental to all areas of law, understanding the technicalities of how legislation is drafted and how it's interpreted by courts. And a lot of my work has been around legislation. So I was the head of legislation and policy at the Irish Human Rights Commission. That's an independent statutory body which advises the government on compliance with human rights standards. I have worked in the NGO sector, including I ran the Irish Penal Reform Trust for 7 years, which was involved really in trying to see if we could shape and change the direction of penal policy in Ireland, particularly with regard to the prison system, sentencing, treatment of young people by the criminal justice system. I took a break from kind of human rights for a few years, well, to an extent at least, and worked for the president, for Michael D. Higgins, as his advisor. I suppose the reason I took that role is I'd be a strong believer in the kind of visions and principles of the president. But the role is an interesting one because even though the president in Ireland, is, as your listeners will know, is a non-executive head of state, so it's not involved in the distribution of state funds or the execution of state policy. What the president does do is he touches on every aspect of the governance of the country. The president's involved in appointing government, appointing judges, has a particular role about testing the constitutionality of laws, and is a key instrument of the foreign policy of the state in terms of engaging with other heads of state. So it's a really interesting kind of office in that you get to see basically how the state works from the inside in all aspects. So I worked with him for 3 years during his first term. And then in 2016, I took over as the director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. I had worked actually with ICCL way back at the start of my career in a policy role back about in the early 2000s. But in this role, I'm involved in running the organization and chief executive. And today we have 14 staff. We have a voluntary board and we work in a fairly broad area, broad range of human rights topics.
Yeah, it's quite a significant organisation with a really interesting history as well. Could you take us back in time and tell us a little bit more about the ICCL itself and its inception and perhaps why it was created?
Yeah, I mean, so Ireland is a small country and we don't have a developed, I suppose, tradition of non-governmental organisations in the way that you see in the United Kingdom or the United States or some other larger countries. The Irish Council for Civil Liberties emerged in the 1970s, inspired by and following on from the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland, which in turn was very much inspired by the civil rights movement in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I suppose it emerged at a time of great conflict on the island. Obviously, we're in the middle of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, where there were real questions about the stability of the state and both states on the island. There was very high level of political violence. And the immediate inspiration for setting up the organization was the attempt by the Irish government in 1976 to expand the emergency powers that were in place to deal with the Troubles, as it was referred to, expanding the power of the criminal justice system and the guards. Mm-hmm. There were also very serious concerns at the time among lawyers about police torture and mistreatment of suspects in custody. And the people that came together to set up the organization included Mary Robinson, who would want to become President of Ireland and UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Donald Barrington, who would want to become Supreme Court Judge, and Kader Asma, who was the real driving force behind the setting up of the organization. Kader was a South African of Indian origin who was a lecturer in law at Trinity College Dublin and had been the key force in establishing the Irish anti-apartheid movement in the 1960s. And following on from that work, also established our organization, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties. Kader would later go on to become a member of the first ANC-led government in South Africa after the return of democracy there. And he's better known for that, but he played a key role in setting up our organization too. I mean, the 1970s was a very difficult time in Ireland, and it was not easy to challenge the state when it came to, first of all, its attempts to maintain order and deal with the challenge of terrorism. And it also wasn't easy to challenge the state on questions of equality. So the agenda really from the start was, on one hand, challenging state power and abuse of counterterrorism, and on the other, about advancing a vision of equality and in particular women's rights. Mm-hmm. And you know, Ireland has changed remarkably, obviously, since that time. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes we need to step back and reflect on those changes. But I think as a very small voluntary organization through the 70s and 80s, basically just run by lawyers, academics, committed members of the public, I think we did make a contribution to public life and public discourse on the big debates of the day, which were counterterrorism, policing, censorship, and then the big equality issues around abortion, divorce, equal status of children, and so on. Mm-hmm. From the 1990s onwards, ICCL became a professionalized organization, and with the availability of some philanthropic support, I think probably took the form of a more sophisticated, established, non-governmental organization, as you'd see in Britain and the United States and elsewhere. And since then, I suppose our work has expanded into a lot of other areas as well.
Yes, and I mean, it came at a great time back in, I suppose, the 60s and 70s. There was a lot of legislative change and changes within the court structure in Ireland as well. I just have a little quote from Mary Robinson, as you said, was one of the founding members, who says, "Looking back on the early days of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, I recall the passion with which we addressed twin challenges, the need to create political and personal space in Ireland through reform of the constitution and laws, and the need to affirm standards of civil liberties in the context of the increasing violence in Northern Ireland. So very significant to hold that space for the development of human rights and for the protection of civil liberties in what were very dark, dark times, you know, in the 70s leading on into the early 80s in Ireland. So as you said, you've mentioned some of the areas of reform that you've been involved in. But even recently, moving on from the 90s, and I suppose in recent decades, there has been huge constitutional change in Ireland. Social change, political reform. How has the ICCL played a role in, you know, advancing those areas? I'm maybe looking at marriage equality, repeal, all of that. Is it through advocacy, or what way do you interact with creating those changes?
Yeah, I mean, there has been huge social change. I think there's always a risk that sometimes we focus on the end of the process of change rather than the long journey, you know. I think the most high-profile social changes that we see in Ireland are around the referendum campaigns on abortion and marriage equality in 2015 and 2018. But both of those were the product, and ICCL played a key role in both referendums, but both are the end of a very long journey. Mm-hmm. And really were expressive of social changes that happened over 20 years or 30 years before that. Yeah. So I suppose ICCL is probably most publicly associated with our work on legislation and engagement with parliaments around law reform and change, and sometimes during referendum campaigns. But there's also a piece of work that's done around engaging with public discourse and trying to play a key role in the public life of the country and in media discussions and in public campaigns that actually help to change minds and shift attitudes over the longer journey. Mm-hmm. And I think both things are important. You know, if we look, for example, at the question of divorce, ICCL was a central actor in the first referendum to introduce legal divorce in Ireland in 1986. A referendum that was defeated by a factor of 2-1. You know, similarly, we were a key player in the referendum campaign to introduce the pro-life amendment in 1983. Again, a referendum that we lost by a very large vote. But the role of organizations like us and the wider feminist movement and the human rights movement in Ireland in articulating principled arguments at that time, you know, played a key role in the evolution of values and society in the time in between. And ultimately, the referendum moments really were giving an imprimatur and a confirmation of a change in attitudes that had happened over that time. So I suppose there's really two levels. Mm. You know, what's in the law is absolutely fundamentally important. And securing law reform and referendum and constitutional change is crucial on its own merits. But it's also linked to wider changes that happen over much longer periods of time. And I think Ireland, thankfully, in the last 10 years, maybe 15 years, we've seen the fruits of the work of lots of actors over a long time. And we've also seen the outplaying of major demographic changes as well, you know. I mean, those of us who grew up in the 1980s will remember that it was the tail end of a very theocratic an oppressive society here, you know, and there's no way of sugarcoating the role that Catholic Church had and a very conservative state had in having a very repressive atmosphere. And on the other side of it, because of the climate of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, there was a very security-driven culture in the justice system. No, we're not. Things are by no means perfect now, and we have a long way to go in some respects. But I think both of those two things have changed to a certain point. The equality part has changed more. Mm-hmm. I think there's still a security mindset that still needs to change. So I think that there's a lot more to be done.
Yeah. And of course, Ireland's going to be put to the test again over the next few weeks whenever they go to vote for constitutional reform. I think it's the 8th of March. Two votes. It seems to be quite controversial. I'm not sure. There seems to be debate around the wording of the change coming forward in respect of the woman's place in the home. And I can see that your organisation is obviously involved in that with a lot of the other NGOs and various reform organisations too. So that'll be a major test, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a view among some lawyers that after marriage equality and after repeal, that a lot of the shortcomings of the 1937 Constitution had been addressed, mm-hmm. and that, you know, like the Fukuyama kind of quote, you know, have we reached the end of constitutional change mm-hmm. In Ireland? I'm not so sure. I think in many respects, you know, there are the challenges facing our society for the next number of years, I think, are going to be around lingering inequality in our society. Yeah. And that whereas there are a lot of good things about Irish democracy being a stable place and a generally liberal and free place now, it is still a very unequal place.
Yeah.
And I think that that might be the next phase. So I think that's why even progressive organizations and progressive individuals in society are a little bit unimpressed with the government's attempts in the area of care with this referendum, because we understand that state services in Ireland are very much inadequate
yeah.
for those who need to rely on the support of the state, you know? So I think that constitutional reform, progressive reform, is going to be with us for a very long time. I think that there's still a long journey to go on.
Sure, sure. And the organisation, we've looked at Ireland there and what it, in terms of equality and the various changes and progression that has been made. But the organisation has more of an international and a global platform as well, as you feed into various other jurisdictions, depending on what the issue is. Is that something you see going forward?
Well, I think that the international human rights movement is an international movement, that the issues that we face here are not singular, you know.
Sure.
So ICCL is part of a number of international networks and coalitions that cooperate, share ideas. There's a particular relationship, obviously, between ICCL and our colleagues in the human rights movement in Northern Ireland. And ICCL played an important part in campaigning for the peace process, and particularly that there would be a human rights pillar and foundation to the peace process in Northern Ireland. I think since Brexit, that has become much more pertinent again, because I think, you know, on both sides of the island, we're now very acutely aware that Brexit and the departure of the United Kingdom from the EU threatens some of the standards and rights and guarantees that people living in Northern Ireland enjoyed. So, likewise, we try to learn from the human rights struggles and achievements of partners in other parts of the world as well. Mm-hmm. And we also are committed to solidarity. So at the moment, obviously, we're very concerned with what's happening in Gaza and in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. And we have colleagues who work in the human rights movement in Israel and in Palestine. And there's obviously a very strong public concern in Ireland on those issues, you know. It's also true, though, of course, that if you're concerned about human rights and equality in Ireland, you can't just focus
yeah.
on the lawmakers in Leinster House, that we are the recipients of European law. Mm-hmm. And in some of the areas we work in, European Union law has been the driving force to provide equality and anti-discrimination guarantees for Irish people, and particularly for Irish women. But also now today, when many of the issues we work on have a digital dimension, then we're seeing that Absolutely. The source of the important laws is also coming from Brussels. Yeah. So that's an area of our work that is growing, and a lot of the focus of that work as a European dimension as well as an Irish dimension.
Sure. And just staying on that topic as well, it really struck me just when reviewing your work, that was a large focus of it, the big tech, because you have developed the Enforce Unit, which really tackles a lot of that work around artificial intelligence, big tech companies. And what's core to that, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the safeguarding of children around the use of artificial intelligence and big tech companies not really stepping up or being capable of taking responsibility to safeguard children. How is that work developing? And, you know, how is that particular unit going? Is that going to become a large feature of your mandate?
I mean, it is a growing area. It's a growing area for human rights and civil liberties organizations all around the world. And in Ireland, it has a particular, I suppose, outplaying because Ireland has, for various policy reasons, found itself at the center of the global digital infrastructure. Mm-hmm. More than half of the major, what are called very large online platforms in European legal terms, have their European and sometimes wider international non-US headquarters in Dublin. And it has been thrust upon us, I suppose, that we play a big part in the global regulatory framework. You know, surveillance was always an issue for the civil liberties and human rights movement, going right back to when Liberty, or the National Council for Civil Liberty, the UK version, was established in the 1930s. It was concerned with questions of surveillance. They pertained through the Second World War and national ID card systems in Britain. And obviously, through the 70s and 80s here, there was a lot of concern of surveillance, phone tapping, not just by Irish authorities, but also the sharing of private information and private communications with the British authorities and elsewhere too. So there's always been a digital surveillance dimension to civil liberties work. But I think in the last couple of decades, what we're all seeing in society is that no matter what our area of concern is, whether that's discrimination on the basis of sex, whether it's about the distribution of racist material, whether it's to do with workers' rights, that there is a digital dimension in everything we do now. And that means that I think human rights activists have to be literate in digital technology and digital regulation. And we also have to ensure that when people are developing new technologies and trying to regulate technology, that they have a human rights lens when they're doing it. Mm-hmm. So it's really about a marriage of several discourses coming together. Mm-hmm. The issues, I suppose, that we are prioritizing in this area. First of all, there is the increased power of surveillance technology on the part of the state. And we see this with the expanded use of CCTV. But we also see it now with facial recognition technology being proposed in an Irish context. And we're strongly opposing the use of facial recognition technology by the police here. We see a particular problem with the trade in personal data by the global advertising industry. This is about targeted advertising of people, which we see having huge damaging effects on independent journalism, on free and fair elections, and also in terms of causing harm to children and vulnerable people in society. And a third area is the emerging area of artificial intelligence and how states and international bodies like the EU can aspire to regulate artificial intelligence because of the potential that it has to do great good, but also cause great harm.
Sure. And looking at the Irish context as well, there is a new online regulator as well, which will obviously be important to the progression of your work around this. And also the Oireachtas Children's Committee, which I know the ICCL has been very prominent in terms of feeding into progression around this issue where it comes to the safeguarding of children, which seems to be really core to a lot of the developments around this. Of course, any parents or anybody listening will have this as a main concern, given recent media reports about the dangers that have faced children. So that's a really brilliant piece of work, and also, as you said, a very new and emerging piece of work that Ireland really seems to be taking a lead on, if I'm correct, or should be taking a lead on given its setting.
Yeah, like, it's an incredibly difficult area.
Yeah.
One of the reasons it's so difficult is because our traditional means of defending and protecting people's rights focus on curtailing the actions of the state. And what we have here are global corporations, which are the richest and most powerful in the history of capitalism, mm-hmm. which operate on a multinational basis, are more powerful and have more resources than the governments that are trying to regulate them, and are able to move their operations around between states to avoid paying tax, which is obviously a particular tricky issue for Ireland, but also to avoid regulation. And there's a particular challenge with online platforms about the extent to which they are responsible or not for the harmful content that is put on. Yeah. You know, decisions were taken very early on in the regulation of the internet that the platforms were not publishers, that they don't have, you know, legal responsibility for the content that's on them, and then absolve themselves of responsibility when that content causes harm. It's a really difficult question for governments and international bodies to regulate. And I think some of the solutions come forward sometimes can be counterproductive. So I think everybody is trying to solve the same problem, but it's proven incredibly difficult. Wow. One of the things that we've tried to bring to the debate here is a focus on how harmful content is distributed, how it reaches large audiences, rather than trying to regulate it at source. Because the regulation of content at source and defining what's harmful or not is very difficult from a free speech perspective. Mm-hmm. But actually, we think the real problem is how the platforms make money out of distributing it to large audiences. Yeah. And I think the recent Oireachtas hearings that you refer to, there was some really troubling evidence given by some global experts about how social media companies monetize driving children to more and more extreme content.
It's
really distressing to hear that.
It is, yeah.
And I think that just shows that we really need to focus on the commercial drivers behind why our internet is becoming such a toxic and dangerous place.
Mm-hmm. And for anybody who's interested in seeing this, you do have a huge amount of information under a specific, I said the Enforce unit is there on your website for anybody to find out more in this, because it really is very innovative and, as you said, a new and emerging and very important area of the law to look at. I guess we've kind of covered this in your answer, but I'm interested, Liam, just in hearing your perspective on what we ask many of our guests in terms of activism and the law and how the two work together to make change. I know that's essentially the core of your organisation in many ways, but what's your opinion on that? Everybody comes up with their own perspective.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people ask us, what is a human rights lawyer? And I wouldn't be facetious, but sometimes you're tempted to think that anybody who calls themselves a human rights lawyer probably isn't. Whereas on the other hand, I would say every person involved in the law is engaged in defending and respecting rights. That's fundamentally what people do for their clients. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there is huge potential to strengthen and advance the protection of law or protection of rights through litigation and also then through the process of law reform. In Ireland, it's more difficult than it is in some jurisdictions because access to justice here isn't as open as it is in some other places. So that means that very often individual citizens find it difficult to vindicate their rights through the courts because of the cost of access to justice, and also our rules on standing and our rules on funding of litigation make it difficult for charities and not-for-profit organizations to advance human rights through the courts in the way that they do in other countries. Mm. So I think that lawyers and the legal system are central to the advance and development of our rights culture and rights protections here, but there are some barriers which make that difficult. And I think what is frustrating from a human rights perspective in Ireland is that there are a lot of human rights issues that I think could be advanced through the courts more, but it's hard for people to bring those cases.
Sure.
And, you know, whereas the human rights climate in the United Kingdom, I think, is much more hostile, governments in recent years have been much more regressive against the rights of the citizens there. Yeah. It's still easier to take the government to court in Britain than it is here. And I think that that is an area where we are deficient, you know? So
yeah.
I think that there's an untapped potential in our legal system for lawyers to bring strong human rights cases on behalf of vulnerable people in society that would actually really improve our society. And the courts could do this, but it's hard to do it because of access questions, which is I think frustrating for many.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, really interesting to make that distinction. Well, finally, Liam, just in terms of the ICCL, how would anybody listening support your work or get involved? How could they find out more? Because it's really, really such a progressive and impactful organisation.
Well, we'd be delighted to hear from lawyers in particular or others that would be interested in contributing to our work. As you said, Sarah, our website, www.iccl.ie, has a huge amount of information about the organisation. We are a membership organisation, so it is possible for people to join and become members and to follow our work on social media. We are trying to, as we grow as an organisation, we are trying to grow our membership, but also give people opportunities to take part in campaigns and, you know, contact their elected representatives on the issues that we're working on. At the moment, I would say the most intense question for us is the question of facial recognition technology. The government is proposing to introduce what is already in the United Kingdom, police use of facial recognition technology, which raises really fundamental questions about privacy rights of individual citizens, their right to peaceful protest. We've seen from both the UK and the US how this type of technology can have a really devastating impact on individual rights and democracy. And we think there's a very good chance that what the government is doing here is illegal. And we think there's a potential to stop them. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the issues that's most in focus for us at the moment. We're also leading the Coalition Against Hate Crime, which is a civil society coalition, which is campaigning for strong hate crime legislation in Ireland, but also legislation which respects freedom of expression as well, gets the balance right mm-hmm. between what is sadly a growing problem in Ireland about people being targeted because of their race, their religion, their sexual orientation or identity. And being the victims of crime because of who they are. We think that these are two areas where Ireland can either do something very progressive that will help, solidarity in the community, but also the opportunity to avoid making mistakes that other countries have made mm-hmm. in terms of expanding the surveillance culture within the society. So there's a lot of very important work happening just at the moment. And we're always delighted to have new supporters and allies in advancing their work.
That's excellent. Well, look, Liam, thank you so much for giving us your time today. Truly, truly interesting stuff. And we look forward to following the work of you and your organisation. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining me today. If you like the show, please remember to share and leave a review if you have a moment. And you can also check out our website, www.activistlawyer.com, where you will see some blog articles written by our guests and contributors, as well as some fabulous Activist Lawyer merchandise.
This podcast was recorded in Granite Podcast Studio. Interested in starting up your own podcast but don't know how? Granite Podcast Studio can help. Record your podcast in our state-of-the-art studio, which is based in the heart of Newry City. Our studio has cutting-edge and user-friendly technology and can seat up to 4 people. We also provide an editing service where our team using your guidance and editing notes to provide you with a flawless finished product, leaving your listeners wanting more. For more information on how you can get started, visit www.granitepodcaststudio.com.